Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am Diana Dur, one of the hosts of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Professor Sabine Frustuck about her new book, Playing War, Children and the Paradoxes of Modern Militarism in Japan, published by the University of California Press in 2017. As stated in the introduction of the monograph, this book is about childhood, war, and play. In Playing War, Professor Frustuck shows how children and childhood have been used in 20th century Japan as technologies to moralize war, and later in the 21st century to sentimentalize peace. Professor Frustuck, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, no worries. Professor, I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself. How did you become interested in East Asian studies and specifically in Japan?
I grew up in Austria, and my parents and my entire family was always interested in other cultures and traveled a lot all around the world. And I had some interesting ideas about what Japan was like. And Japan from actually very early on interested me a lot, along with other parts of Asia. But I settled on Japan partly because Japan seemed so diverse in terms of both having a very long cultural development as well as a modern society today.
Oh, I see. Oh, thank you for sharing that. Now, can you tell us about how you came to write Playing War?
I've done work on a number of different issues, including the history of sexology, and I've also written an ethnography of the contemporary military in Japan. And in all of this work over the last 20 years or so, the military and modes of militarization reappeared in unexpected places. For instance, in my work on sexology, it became clear to me that the military and conscripts in particular, young men in particular, were actually the largest relatively homogeneous population that the state had access to, and thus a lot of data about health, about literacy, about all kinds of issues were based on conscript exams. By the same token, when looking into how the contemporary military functioned and how soldiers in contemporary Japan made sense of their role in a larger society and in the world and compared to other military organizations, I discovered that they were actually very thoughtful about what kind of images they project. They were very cognizant of the fact that they labored under the legacy of the Imperial Army and the Second World War, Asia-Pacific War. And so in a number of different contexts, the military popped up. And together with the military also, the idea that it is children that are open to education, manipulation, indoctrination. And so it matters to the military in contemporary Japan, as well as it mattered to the military state in early 20th century, in 19th century, late 19th century Japan, to convince the children first that military and war are reasonable things, are reasonable organizations, are useful to the kinds of societies they live in.
Oh, that's really interesting. Your work on Japanese masculinity and the contemporary military is also really fascinating. I urge our listeners to take a look at Professor Frestuck's other works as well. So the book opens with a discussion on the vulnerability hypothesis. Can you explain what this hypothesis is that your book is trying to examine?
Certainly. So the title itself, or the name itself, is really a play on Michel Foucault's repressive hypothesis, or his critique of the repressive hypothesis. And in his critique, he essentially unsettles and challenges the idea that in earlier societies, prior to modernity, sexuality was essentially repressed, particularly in France, of course, and in European societies. And instead, he introduces the idea and then also shows how this idea played out in another three volumes of his history of sexuality. There were several forces at work, and modernity in particular did not bring liberation or freedom to sexual practice primarily, but rather a different regime of control, a different regime of power that reorganized, reconfigured, and resignified sexuality and various sexual practices. And so with that in mind, the vulnerability hypothesis I propose at the beginning of the book is addressing the notion in, and this is a distinctly modern notion in this coherence in any case, the notion that children are inherently vulnerable, are inherently weak, are in need of protection. And so by this vulnerability hypothesis, by proposing this vulnerability hypothesis, I suggest that, yes, the modern Japanese regime, and of course, along with the state, the education establishment, the creative class, a whole lot of educated and ordinary men and women came to embrace the idea that children were really a separate kind of population that needed its own education, its own consumer products, its own kind of safety net, securities, protection, educational institutions, welfare institutions, and legal systems. But at the same time, these same entities, including the state, also discovered and recognized children as incredibly useful in the pursuit of goals that are really working against children, such as war. And so it's this contradiction and this inherent contradiction, I think, that I introduce with the notion of the vulnerability hypothesis.
This is indeed a really refreshing perspective that you're giving here. So let's start with the chapters of the book. Chapter one is entitled Field Games, explores how children's little wars are actually connected and interacted with the grand game, a term that you use to refer to the grand maneuvers of the Imperial Army and Japan's wars in Asia. So how have Japanese children learned to conceive war and play?
Yes, so the first two chapters deal with these children's games. The first is in the games in the field, and the second, the games on paper and with other kinds of toys, more or less inside. What we know from historical records is that children have always played games in the field that essentially pitch one group of children against another. But it was only in the late 19th century and then in the early 20th century when children themselves to some degree began to adopt the adult language of war, of specific kinds of wars, the Sino-Japanese War at the end of the 19th century and then the Russo-Japanese War at the beginning of the 20th and so on, that they started to adopt and make sense of their little battles in terms of military battles. And so we have this fabulous record of an 1850s story of two groups of boys encountering each other and battling each other. And they envisioned themselves as the Japanese against the Americans. And of course, this is a reference to the black ships of the mid-19th century and the opening of Japan to the United States. And so they battle each other. And by surely by mistake, one of the boys on the Japanese side injures the leader of the other side that represents the United States. And unfortunately, this other boy dies. The case is taken to court, and the court decides that the Japanese boy has done the right thing. And in fact, he isn't being punished at all. In fact, he gets a stipend for pursuing his studies. And so it's this interconnection that is made both rhetorically and in a playful way by children, as well as by adult institutions, like in this case, the court, later media and other kinds of institutions that begin to discover that these children's games can in fact be re-signified and reutilized in order to prepare children, both in terms of their thinking, but also in terms of their physical preparation for later adult conflict. And so it's very, very interesting, I think, that even though Japan was at war repeatedly from the late 19th century to 1945, it's at that time, around the 20s, at the turn of the 20th century, and at the beginning of the 20th century, that media still, when children play these games and injure each other, and it happens repeatedly, the children fall into rivers and die during these games. And so at the beginning of the 20th century, it's still very, very common for newspapers to say, parents, watch out, be careful, make sure the children are inside in the evening, that they don't engage in these kinds of dangerous games. And so it's very slowly at the beginning of the 20th century when the adult world shifts and discovers the utility of these games and the possibilities and the potential of these games for adult goals. Children themselves comment in a variety of different ways about that. So we have records, for instance, from around the Russo-Japanese War at the beginning of the 20th century, where children are told about the Russo-Japanese War in school. And they come home and they tell their parents, for instance, that on the next day they're going to go out and fight the Russians and they might not return. And the background to this, of course, was a teacher who framed one of their field exercises, educational exercises, in these terms. And so children adopted that kind of language and that kind of understanding. There are other records from children themselves who suggest that these games are really only fun when they play them among themselves and without adult supervision. And so there are different kinds of perspectives, but schools and even elementary schools and kindergartens at the beginning of the 20th century begin to adopt military-style exercises, shooting so-called shooting practices in their education. And so the kinds of games the children play become increasingly incorporated and then re-signified within institutional contexts, and then also controlled and commandeered by adults.
Yeah, this is really fascinating. Like you argued in the chapter that, you know, this playing war really embodies also this modern notion of continuous war, right? That through playing childhood, it's a sense of continuing into the adulthood. And chapter two, paper battles, like you just said at the beginning, also talks about how children involve or conceive war and play. So Paper Battles looks at how children's war games were intertwined with the experience of nature, territory, and the empire. Can you maybe tell us a little bit about how have children's games changed from nation building to empire building in the 20th century?
Yes, so this is very interesting because what we haven't talked about yet in our conversation are, of course, distinctions among children. We can't just assume that they were all the same and all the same all over Japan in urban and rural areas. So the way I think it's useful to think about these paper games is, of course, that they are played by children who might also play these field games outside, but many more children also who don't play these games outside and exclusively play in a perhaps urban context, perhaps in a middle-class context, where they are inside and play similar games on paper. And so the empire perspective on this has very much to do with how the games play out on paper. So on the one hand, we have, for instance, Sugoroku. These are paper games where you play with dice, and depending on your result, you move a number of fields. And each field then represents a particular activity or represents a particular kind of step forward. And of course, particularly during the 1930s and 1940s, these moves forward were very much represented in colonizing kinds of contexts. So for instance, you have a group of children landing at some shore, or you have children move through the field, but the way the field is structured is very much like, for instance, railways, pathways that mock at least a map of Manchuria, for instance. And so the notion of continuous war here is adapted to these children's games to primarily underemphasize the distinction between war and play, and the distinction between a Sugoroku map, for instance, so a play map, a game map, and an actual map that, of course, has been partly produced by the military and other kinds, and earlier kinds of explorers, of course. And so the shift to the empire as the main frame of these games very much has to do with how much of that empire and how much of these front lines is actually represented in children's games.
Yeah, this is certainly really interesting. And chapter three, let's just move on. Moral Authority of Innocence examines this use value that you have introduced of children and the emotional capital that has been attributed to children. Can you tell us more about these in the context of war as well as in peace, and also maybe your theoretical approach and the affect turn that you're taking here?
Yes, so chapter three and four really look at the connections of children and war from a different perspective and through the lens both of visual culture and the lens of the emotionality that is attributed to children and to childlike things or child artifacts, including toys and pictures and games, of course. And so I've adapted Pierre Bourdieu's notion of social and cultural capital for these purposes, and I call this emotional capital. So it's less about the emotions children might have, but rather it's the emotions that we assume and that we attribute to the image of a child, for instance, the photograph of a child, or anything that has to do with children. And so we need to understand that it's really the beginning of the 20th century in Japan when a kind of children's culture emerges that is urban and modern and driven by a capitalist market economy. And so in very similar terms, the creative class, illustrators, children's book authors, producers of children's magazines, and producers of toys understand that once a child is in the picture, literally in the picture, adults tend to have warm and fuzzy feelings about what the picture is about. So for instance, in the 1930s and early 1940s, we have an enormous proliferation of images of soldiers with children. And so these are images that appear across a number of media. First of all, of course, this is the time when photography really begins to thrive as a private pastime, as a pastime of the middle class. Family photography, photo albums, family albums become a thing. And so it's that time, of course, when we have an increasing number of children that are depicted in sort of children's versions of military uniforms, that are depicted with adult members of the families who are in uniforms, and so on and so forth. So there's one place for that. Then we have children's games, children's magazines, books that constantly depict Imperial Army members that are often depicted as brothers, as uncles, as fathers, who either embrace their own children at home, for instance, in the context of departure to the front, or, and this is much more prevalent, are depicted encountering children behind the front lines in occupied territories after the battle, in colonized territories. And what kind of encounters do we see? It's always friendly encounters. There's always, in the Japanese case, it's not chocolate. It's usually caramels that are given by Japanese Imperial Army soldiers to Chinese children, to Manchurian children, to other kinds of children, not distinguished beyond the fact that they are not Japanese. And so we have these encounters are very, very prominent across a number of different media. And so I suggest in this chapter in particular that the moral authority of innocence, the assumption that children, particularly children under the age of 12, that they are innocent, actually is not a neutral comment. It's completely politicized here. And so we, in these materials of the 1930s and 40s, children are massively, depictions of children are massively used in order to redeem these soldiers, in order to constantly signal to Japanese children at home and their adult caretakers and other adults that Japanese Imperial Army members do good things abroad. They rescue children. They embrace these children. They behave just as lovingly right behind the front lines as they would at home with their own children and other underage faculty members. And so that's where I see the emotional capital of children at work, massively exploited by a militarist imperialist state, as well as the creative class that labors under this particular regime.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Oh, these are certainly really penetrating observations that you're offering here. And similarly, children do appear in various modes of querying war, the process of querying war, as well, that you talk about in specifically in detail in chapter 4. So what is the role for children in these modes? Are they also similarly exploited?
So of course, one interesting aspect of military societal relations in Japan is of course that Japan was a massively militarist nation and empire until 1945, and then broke with that tradition very clearly after 1945. And so in the wake of the Korean War, of course, the self-defense forces were established, the current day armed forces of Japan. And for the longest time, until very, very recently, when the Abe administration changed the legal conditions under which, at least part of the legal conditions under which the self-defense forces operate, the self-defense forces were very, very self-aware and very conscious of the fact that the Japanese Constitution, Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution, explicitly prohibits Japan from entertaining a standing army and very explicitly prohibits Japan from waging war. And so particularly the ground self-defense forces, the army, was very self-aware of these restrictions, was very cautious about appearing in public. And so it was very uncommon, particularly in urban Japan, and still is very uncommon in urban Japan, for members of the self-defense forces to be in uniform outside of their bases. And this, of course, is particularly the case for the army, because the army is... this is, of course, universal, but the army tends to be the branch of the military that is made most responsible for the defeat. And at the same time, in the Japanese case, the Imperial Japanese Army, from all we know, has been most involved in war crimes. So in any case, the current armed forces in Japan very much labor under the legacy of the Imperial Armed Forces. And so they've been very, very cautious for decades and decades to produce images for public consumption in terms of public relations efforts, but also particularly recruitment. In the last few decades, and I think the first deployments of the self-defense forces at the beginning of the 1990s on peacekeeping operations were a crucial shift. In the last few decades, the military has come to the conclusion that it is, in fact, important, particularly for recruitment, but also for their sort of standing within society, to produce its own image, to not try as best as they can to be invisible, as they have done for several decades, but to really think about what kind of images of themselves they should be projecting to the Japanese population at large, but also, and this is equally important here, also to other parts of Asia that were formerly under Japanese colonial rule, and of course to the most important ally of Japan, the United States. And so I list these three kinds of constituency because that makes things very, very complicated for the Japanese military. To its own population, it needs, of course, to project competence. To the population in other parts of Asia, it needs to project the understanding that the contemporary military is no longer the imperial army. The contemporary military would never do the kinds of things that the imperial army has done across Asia. And to the United States, of course, it needs to also project a somewhat different image, namely that it is ready to align itself with American armed forces, that it is ready to collaborate as a fully fledged partner, and so on and so forth. So these are very different kinds of goals. And during the last few decades, and I've followed this very closely, both with respect to public opinion surveys and with material that the Japanese military produces to create and really reshape its public image, what they have done is to pick up on Japanese popular culture and, ironically, paying attention to the enormous soft power of Japanese popular culture within Japan and globally has meant the reintroduction of children, both in terms of child figures as well as popular culture that is appealing to children, into their public relations campaigns. And so in today's public relations campaigns, in a lot of them, not all of them, but a lot of them, particularly those that are meant for domestic consumption and Asian consumption, the military uses things that have appeal for the very youngest members of society. So when you compare this, for instance, to an American body of recruitment campaigns, and of course we need to acknowledge here that in the United States as well, different branches of the military pursue different kinds of images and so on and so forth. But I think it's important if you look at this from a distance and very broadly, you will see that a lot of what the Japanese military does in terms of shaping its public image and projecting what they hope will be positively received is, in fact, designed to appeal to the very young parts of the population and is very much framed in terms that is aligned with popular culture. So there's a lot of cuteness. There's a lot of naivete. There's a lot of also girlishness in these campaigns. And so if you compare this to, let's say, the United States or some other militaries, of course, there's a lot of variation around the world. You'll see that even though there are changes in around the world in what kinds of images military establishments try to project, in many of them, there's a lot about military service will give you a competence that is applicable to civilian life. There's a lot about adventure. There's a lot about camaraderie, about defense, about patriotism, about the kinds of martial messages that have to do with a particular kind of notion of what proper masculinity is supposed to be like. And so I'm simplifying here, of course. We have a great variety of images everywhere. But when you look at these campaigns, the Japanese look of it is very, very soft. It's trying to be educational, and educational in terms of a very young population. And so in this, at this particular moment, and this is very interesting, in the 21st century, we have sort of an echo of the wartime uses of children, of course, with very different messages, but it's the current campaign apparatus, the public relations apparatus that has rediscovered the usefulness, the utility of childlike appeals and of the child as a whole cultural kind of complex for the purposes of projecting a positive image of the military, both in terms of competence and capability, but even more so in terms of the great variety of missions, particularly the Japanese military engages today, including disaster relief internationally and domestically, and peacekeeping.
Oh, this is really fascinating. And I guess our conversation now will lead us perfectly into the epilogue, your discussions in the epilogue, The Rule of Babies in Pink. So here you observe a dramatic move from the infantilization of war to the infantilization of peace in the 21st century Japan. So when and why did this move occur?
There are several moments throughout the book, although this is not a comparative book at all, but there are several moments throughout the book where I look up from the Japan case and look around the world, or particular places around the world that give us further clues on how to make sense of the situation in Japan. The epilogue is such a moment where I look around and look at how do media around the world, how do other countries bring in children in the context of a war and peacemaking. And so what we discover when looking around is very much that the use of the child to both appease and legitimize war has sort of blended together. And so we'll see this in the context of situations like military organizations being involved in disaster relief. When you pay attention to what kind of media images are actually projected by the large news agencies and corporations, you'll find that very, very often you'll have a member of the military, preferably male, in full military gear, carrying a baby. And very often this baby is dressed in pink. That's just how things work with baby clothes, I suppose. But very often we have the connection between a particular, often very violent, disastrous kind of event. And so again, current uses of the military, of course, are various and range from war and combat to disaster relief. And so we have the constant bringing together of children and the notion of children being deeply vulnerable and victims of these events, and war as one of them, and soldiers who, of course, in some of these contexts, have committed acts of mass violence and yet are redeemed, so to speak, with images of babies, preferably, or very small children in the eyes of civilian populations at home, around the world, in various different contexts. And so it's very, very important to understand here that the kind of utility that children had in the war context of the early 20th century in Japan and in other places has now shifted in a much broader context and is applied to the kinds of situations that make it very hard for us to distinguish what where war ends and where peacekeeping operations begin, for instance. And so what I observe here is the kinds of uses of children in these images and in these reports today, in fact, are not the do not lie in the notion of the child being vulnerable and thus primarily associated with peace, but in fact are a reiteration of what we've seen in earlier times and, of course, we continue to see in certain parts of the world today. And the context of that is, of course, war in a number of different places.
So lastly, the epilogue argues, and I quote here from the book, that the infantilization tactics of both the war-making military establishment and military humanitarian missions have blurred the line between war and peace in today's highly globalized world. Can you maybe speak a bit more about this blurring of the line between war and peace and maybe its future implications?
Yes, what I see in what I describe in the epilogue and what you just articulated as the blurring of the lines, of course, has to do with the very notion of how the emotionality that we ascribe to children is politically useful for a number of different goals. And that should make us pause whenever we encounter images or rhetorical attempts to employ children in a number of political ways. We should not fall into that trap that just because there's a child in the picture with the military, that military action is legitimate and will necessarily lead to a positive end for that child as well as for the societies involved in general.
Well, thank you, Professor Frustuck. I think we've taken up a lot of your time. And thank you so much for sharing your incredible research with us. I had a really great time reading your book. But before we conclude our interview, could you maybe tell us a bit about your current research projects? What have you been working on recently?
Oh, I'm working on a number of different things. One is a history of gender and sexuality in modern Japan that I hope to complete within the year. And I'm also probing further the history of emotions in Japan and historically as well as contemporarily. And as you've seen in the book, I have an increasing interest in visual culture. And so I'm particularly interested in different modes of articulating emotions in Japanese culture.
Oh, that sounds like a great project. I'm sure our listeners will also be certainly looking forward to it. And finally, I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed reading your book, and I urge our listeners to pick up a copy of Playing War too. Take care.
Thank you so much.